Okay, is this working? Hi. That's an American hi, not a Japanese hi. I was brought up in evangelical church, non-charismatic, and some of the people in the church came in contact with the charismatic movement and started acting like charismatics. So the the leaders of the church got together. The question was, how do we get rid of these charismatics? And they had various theories. Finally, somebody came up with the right one. They said, let's just lower the ceiling fans. So you see what happens. All right, so it wasn't that good a joke anyway. I want to talk about memories, and you've got the handout there. See, the question is, we've got people with the kinds of problems we were talking about last night, and question is, how do you get them fixed? And the church's record on this has been very, very poor. In fact, most of our church leaders, when somebody needs help, they recommend a secular approach, recommend secular psychologists. Some of these psychologists are Christians, but they're still, you know, practicing a secular approach to things. And their own studies, the studies of psychologists, indicate that their success rate is not nearly what it should be, given the amount of time and money and energy that's put into a psychological thing. People get supported, but often not healed. And I think I found some reasons for that I'd like to share with you, and that's this stuff related to memories. There are people who spend all their lifetime studying memories, studying the kinds of memories that we have, and they tell us that we have different kinds of memories. The kind of memory that is most in focus is called semantic memory. This is the memory of facts and information and the storage of that information. And this is a very important kind of memory. And it feeds right into the kind of intellectualistic approach to Christianity that our most of our churches are into. In fact, I think the biggest heresy we've got is intellectualization. That you know, things are head things. A story from a former pastor. He's passed away now, but he got into inner healing. Because he was serving as pastor of a fairly large church, and so as a pastor he was, you know, grinding out sermon after sermon after sermon, week by week. But he also had a counseling ministry. That is, people would come to him during the week to get help with their the kinds of problems that counselors get to deal with. And all of a sudden it occurred to him that his preaching was out of touch with his counseling. That is, what he was preaching about was one set of things, generally sort of theological things, biblical themes. But what people were coming to him for during the week was dealing with emotional things. And so he changed his preaching. He became a preacher dealing with emotional issues. And he's written several several books. This is David Siemens is his name. Dealing with what we now call inner healing. Now, we have this, what I just called semantic memory, collecting facts. And those of us that have been to a lot of school, we just have stacks and stacks and stacks of information on all kinds of largely irrelevant subjects. but most of what we do in school is stuffing our minds with this stuff, much of which is irrelevant. And I guess the farther we go in school, the more we become collectors of this information. But the memory people tell us that, okay, that's semantic memory, but we have another kind of memory too. In fact, we have two other kinds of memory, and we'll get to them in detail. One is what they call a procedural memory. This is, deals with things like reflexes, how we move our hands and arms and legs and ride bicycles and this kind of thing. We won't spend much time on that today. But they tell us there's another kind of memory yet that occurs in pictures rather than in words. And he said that the events of our lives, we store them in our minds in pictures. See, the semantic memory is, literacy is a major part of it, and that's linearized. You get this fact, and you get this fact, and this fact, and this fact. A picture-based memory, you get a picture all at once, don't you? In fact, I saw a picture of me this morning on Facebook. Somebody, who did that? Nothing wrong with it, I guess, but there I am standing, and I don't know what the turnaround on these things is, but it seemed pretty quick to me. But they say we store all of the good things that happen to us, the good events, in good pictures. The bad events in pictures we might call bad pictures or damaged pictures. So the question is, if people are coming for help because they've got damaged pictures in their minds, how do we get those fixed? And that's the subject of this, that's chapter 3 in my book, 2 Hours to Freedom. Things are stored, obviously, in memories. Being a Christian is not enough. As Christians, we say, where is healing? Where is the freedom that Jesus promised us? Frequently, Christians are discouraged because a pastor has used Philippians 3:13. Do you know that verse? Paul is saying, forgetting those things that are behind, we press forward towards the mark of the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. And people take that verse out of context and assume that he's talking about forgetting the bad stuff that's happened. But if you look at the context, you find out he's not talking about forgetting the bad stuff. He's saying, in order to achieve this next goal that God has put before us, we got to forget the good stuff. He says, if anybody has a right to brag, it's me. Or if you're an English teacher, they say, it's I. But nobody talks that way except English teachers. our oldest kids are twins, and they came home from high school one day with some kind of garbage that the English teacher had taught them. And I said, that's wrong. And they looked at me and said, who are you to say that's wrong? Because, you're just a parent, and parents, by definition, don't know anything. And so they didn't believe that. And I said, well, let me put it this way. I teach at a university called UCLA, and I teach in the linguistics department. And your teacher might go for an advanced degree, and if she went for an advanced degree, she might come and take one of my courses, and I would be her teacher. And my kids said, oh. And as soon as they saw me as a teacher, they accepted my word. But as long as they just saw me as a parent, it was useless to try to get anything into their heads. That's the way our society is. But see, Philippians 3:13, Paul is saying, I can brag about the things that I did before I became a Christian. I can brag about the way God is using me now. But if I'm going to continue to grow, continue to serve, continue to do God's will, I've got to put those things behind me. I can't spend my time parading my good works. So anybody that uses that verse to suggest that we should forget the bad things is misusing it. That's not what's intended. Now, the question is, what is God's approach? Does he say, just stuff it, forget it, put it behind you? Not at all. There's this interaction that Jesus had with Peter after Peter had denied him three times. Did he say to Peter, just forget it? No, as a matter of fact, he dramatized the whole thing. Jesus was into pictures, wasn't he? You know, you look in the New Testament, you find out how he taught. He taught in what we call parables. These are pictures. He's drawing pictures. He says, the kingdom of heaven is like this picture. The kingdom of heaven is like this picture. So he didn't leave it there. He met Peter on the beach, and he says, hey, Pete, let's talk. And I'm pretty sure that Peter expected to be condemned, because he had let his best friend, Jesus, down at the time of his need. But instead, Jesus asked him a question. The question is, do you love me? What he's saying is, what's our relationship now? Now that you've gone through this experience, do we still have a relationship? And Peter says, yeah, I love you. Anyway, Jesus did that three times. Why did he do it three times? Because Peter had denied him three times. So he's dramatized. And it's kind of interesting. Jesus was there on the beach, and he made a fire, and they were cooking some fish, I guess, to eat. And there's a word in the New Testament that denotes the kind of coals that fire is made up of. That word occurs twice in the New Testament. Once when Peter was denying Jesus, and once when Jesus was meeting him on the beach. So he not only pictured it, he dramatized the whole thing. And he was saying to Peter, face what you've done and recognize I still love you, you still love me, and we go through it. We don't go around it. We don't stuff it, kind of thing. And that's God's approach. That's his approach with sin. He doesn't say, just forget your sins. He says, confess them. Admit it. Deal with it. Go straight through it and get it healed. And that's what this is all about. Now, stuff stored in memories. We want people to experience healing, not just to know about it, not just to talk about it, not just to think about it, but to actually experience it. And the best way to experience things is to go inside to the pictures, to find those pictures. Some of you have been abused, and you may be afraid to go back to picture the abusive situation, because that represents the hurt, the pain, the emotional illness that you've had. But Jesus says, go back to it as a surgeon goes. See, I often ask people, have you had surgery? Yeah. Did it hurt? Oh, yeah, it hurt. Well, why'd you do it? It's kind of stupid to, to invite somebody to hurt us. Unless on the other side of that hurt is healing. The same is true about emotional hurt. If we can face it with Jesus, on the other side of it, it's healing. Now, again, in pictures, we ask people to picture. And the way to get healed is to go back to the event, put yourself in that position again, picture it, experience it, and then see a part of the truth that you didn't see before. And that is the presence of Jesus there. Now, we know theologically that Jesus is what we say omnipresent. He is everywhere at all times. He's here with each one of us, isn't he? And he's also in, God-forsaken places like America. He's there too. Or other places, he's there too. He's everywhere. And he was there when you were being hurt. Now, why he didn't do something to stop it, I can't explain that. But I do know that he was with you. I was working with a lady one time, and her father, all the time she was growing up, would beat her. She didn't know why. She had this horrible feeling that her father didn't love her, and that he was taking out his own stuff on her, and so on. And I said, okay, Jesus says we've got to forgive, no matter how bad the stuff was. In fact, he makes it conditional. The verses after the Lord's Prayer, he said, if we don't forgive those who have hurt us, then don't expect God to forgive us. That's pretty serious. So I said, you're going to have to forgive your father. I'm really sorry about that, because he doesn't deserve it one little bit. He deserves your revenge. But Jesus says, give it to me. I'll take care of him. That one's scary. He says, vengeance is mine. I will repay. So this lady, she went back to picture it. She closed her eyes, went back, and she saw herself curled up in the corner with her father beating her. And she started crying. And I just said, where's Jesus? And she started to say, he's not. They said, oh, here he is. She saw Jesus. Now she's picturing the truth. This is not a made-up thing. Jesus was with her. She saw him down on the floor with her, taking the beating with her. And this, the fact that he was with her, the fact that she could experience his presence even in this horrible situation, without answering the question, why does God let a father beat his daughter? Like I said, we don't know the answer to that question, but she didn't need the answer anymore. What she recognized was that she had the presence and power of Jesus, who loved her enough to take the beating with her. And on that basis, she was able to forgive her father and get free. Interesting, huh? That's what makes inner healing fun. Incidentally, some of you probably will have questions. If you could write them down and get them to us, say at lunchtime or something like that, then this afternoon I'll take some time and try to answer those questions. Now, on page 16 in your notes, we talk about these memories. See, this young lady that saw her father beating her in the corner, this is stored in her memories in a picture. And now she's seeing the picture with another part of the truth in it, with Jesus in it. So she is, she is forever in the future now, seeing Jesus with her in that horrible situation. Now, some of the things that the memory people are coming up with are just fascinating to me. Many believe our brains start recording just about everything that happens to us in about 6 to 8 weeks of gestation. That means you're in your mother's womb 6 to 8 weeks, and your mind is recording things. I referred to this a little bit last night. That means these pictures are getting put into your memory. Now, if your parents are fighting while you're in the womb, there's a disruption in the picture. The picture is not a... You probably didn't feel safe. And so, but it's stored with all of the hurt. The facts are stored, and also the feelings, your reaction to the feelings. If you're unwanted, I referred last night to the fact that a lot of our cultures don't honor girls. A lot of times our parents want a boy. And a child that's born to parents, born a girl to parents who wanted a boy, feels unwelcome. There's something that we call a curse of unwantedness that you may be born with. The lady that I mentioned last night, the fourth girl in a Chinese family, had that curse of unwantedness that she was born with. And she knew that when she was born. So the memory experts tell us. And that, you know, that then affects her whole life. And like I said, since she has this feeling and doesn't understand things like grown-ups have problems and such, she thinks the problem is hers. And so she condemns herself. Then we're told that we remember experiences in pictures, not in words. This is called episodic memory. If you want to impress your friends, you can use technical terms like this: episodic memory. Boy, that sounds like you're really smart, right? I don't know where they get that name from, but that's what they call it. And I'll come back to that. Then we're told that we remember more of the bad things that happened than of the good things. We're told that we do forget some things, and the things we forget usually are the good things. The things that we remember are the bad things. That's kind of interesting. Our memory of the bad things is more vivid and more accurate than our memory of the good things. In fact, they tell us that if they bring people as witnesses in court, they can trust them more if they're describing something bad than if they're describing something good. Isn't that interesting? That our memory is more accurate of the bad things than of the good things. Though our memories don't actually retain everything that happens to us, they retain a great deal. Now, what we call an inability to remember is really not inability to remember, it's an inability to recall a memory. The memories are there, but trying to recall them, trying to bring them to the surface is often difficult, especially for some of us as we get older. A sixth thing: what can be brought to consciousness and the accuracy of the memories are greatly affected by the strength of the impression the event has on us. I think some of us regularly don't remember a lot of things because they didn't impress us that much. See? A lot of times people will say, well, did this experience meet your expectations? They say that to me, and I say, yeah. I expected whatever would happen. I didn't have expectations. Because if you have certain expectations and then the thing doesn't measure up, then you tend to remember it pretty well. But if you don't have those expectations and you just sort of ride things the way they turn out, there's no reason to really cement that thing in your memory. And I'm amazed. I have a brother-in-law whose memory is just, he's got all kinds of details. He's what, 83 years old or something, and he can go back through his childhood and remember in detail all kinds of things. And I kind of envy him, although it's sort of like he's got a very heavy head full of all these memories. I think some of them get in his way. Things don't impress me that much, so I don't remember them that well. The bad news is it gets worse as you get older. Point seven, contrary to common belief, there are things that we lose, we don't remember. Now, point eight is interesting. Memories are not always factual. A lot of times they're like dreams. There's something there that is coming to the surface, but your memory of it is not totally fact. It's like I said, more like dreams. Point 10, the Holy Spirit can enable us to access memories we can't recall. And that's pretty cool when we're ministering to people and he brings to their attention some things that they hadn't been remembering for a long time or hadn't been recalling. Now, memory stored in pictures, and here's the point, can only be healed through picturing. You can't heal bad pictures with good words. If you want to get bad pictures healed, you need another picture. And we'll come back to that, because there's one picture that is that is very healing for almost everybody, and that is the same event with Jesus in it. When we recognize that Jesus was there, that he's on our side, in spite of how bad the event was, he was with us in it. That's healing, and the way to bring that healing to bear is in pictures. Picture memories cannot be healed through words alone. The most effective healing memory is picturing the painful event with Jesus in it. Now, 12, Jesus is omnipresent, so we know that he was there. When we picture the hurtful memory with Jesus in it, we're picturing the truth. We're not just making this up. Some people accuse us of doing things in a New Age way, because New Age people are advised to construct pictures of what they wish could happen, not what actually did happen. But that's not what we're doing. What we're doing is trying to picture a part of the truth that we had not been conscious of before. Now, these facts coming from the memory people have enormous implications for our task of deep level healing. The fact that memory starts so early means we need to explore pre-birth memories. And we'll do that probably this afternoon. We'll do some exercises that help us in that area, we hope. The fact that our minds record almost everything, whether or not we can recall these things, means if we can just access those memories, go back with Jesus to the memory roots of present-day actions and attitudes, we have a powerful tool to bring about healing. The fact that we remember the bad things, the difficult times, the traumas, gives us quite an advantage in attempting to bring healing to past hurts. The fact that these things are there and it's usually easier to recall them. And the relationship between the strength of an impression and our ability to recall events helps explain why some people can recall lots of things while others don't seem to recall very much at all. Now, this next section is the three main kinds of memory that I've been talking about. I won't spend much time on this procedural memory, even though it's quite important. Deals with how we behave physically, but also our attitudinal reflexes. When something happens, we have an attitude, and we react to it in terms of that attitude. I've talked about this as emotional reflexes, such as reaching to experience or reacting to life experiences in anger, fear, shame, guilt, and so on. This is where that kind of memory is important in our quest here. Then semantic memory, and as I said before, this is where we store the facts and the information. And when people talk popularly about memory, they're usually referring to this kind of memory, just remembering facts and such. This is an important part of our memory, and we focus on it in both schools and church. But this is not where we live. And this the thing that I think is most fascinating is this thing called episodic memory. Picture-based rather than word-based. Memory of feelings and emotions, relationships, personal experiences. This is where we store good experiences. This is where we store our hurts. It's the place where wounds are stored and which needs to be accessed if we are to achieve spiritual and emotional healing. And this is the part most interesting to us. Any questions? Is this kind of snow you? You can see the importance of understanding memory if we're going to be able to go back into memory to bring healing, because all of the abusive stuff, the facts and the feelings are stored in this in pictures in this episodic memory. Now this results in a good bit of criticism of what we usually do in church. Because even sermons are primarily in this thing that we call semantic memory, the information and teaching and so on. But it's the pictures that stick with us. We'll be talking later in the day about demonization. And the picture that I like to draw is rats in garbage. And person after person has come and said that really makes things understandable and concrete. Just one. This is a word picture, then we go back to the New Testament and see that Jesus was talking in pictures. Do you think he knew something we don't know? Probably so. Okay, they're buried memories. If all of our memories, especially of abuse, were on the surface, we'd be a wreck, wouldn't we? We have to be able to sort things and, try to bury them. The problem is we bury them in capsules, and those capsules leak. And certain events as adults then trigger subconsciously, trigger stuff in our memories, and pretty soon we're adults, we're acting like children. This is one way you can raise your hand on this one. How many of you as adults have ever acted like a child? It's usually pretty close to 100%, isn't it? Well, that's this triggering thing. There's a reaction that we learned in childhood in a particular way, and then something in our present life reminds us subconsciously, usually, of that event in childhood, and all of a sudden we're behaving like children, we never intended to, and we say, where did that come from? Yeah. Well, it came from the way we handle memories. And one of the neat things about inner healing is that we can we can deal with healing that memory so that things don't get triggered in our present life, and we're no longer acting like children. Hopefully, some of us manage to do that anyway. Now the Holy Spirit is brought into the process and brings back to our consciousness things that we wouldn't have come to otherwise, and we can be very, very thankful for that. We invite Him to come and to take charge. Now, the impact of damaged memories, like I mentioned last night, some doctors say probably 80% of physical problems have emotional roots. We would say emotional and spiritual roots. I heard that a medical doctor once made the statement, if people would learn to forgive, our hospitals would be empty. Because unforgiveness is the biggest thing that we have to have to get rid of, have to get healed. Now I've got stories of three women here that I dealt with. Each woman had serious problems. I mentioned one last night. Two had had automobile accidents. Another lady came in on her crutches. She had had she'd gotten her knee wrecked in a volleyball game that she'd been involved in. She, of course, when the accident happened, the doctors patched her up and so on. But then she had another appointment with the doctors 2 weeks later, and the doctor's comment was, your knee is worse now than it was before. See, our bodies are made so that if there is an injury, they immediately go about trying to bring healing. What was happening with her was her body was going the opposite direction. It was going towards more hurt rather than towards healing. So we invited the Holy Spirit to take them back to pre-birth, to childhood, and later memories, including the accident. The Holy Spirit healed them from their physical damage as we prayed for the emotional problems. As soon as the emotional problems were dealt with and healed, apparently something in all three of these ladies, something in their physical bodies was released, and didn't even pray for physical healing, but they got well. One lady said, my husband was so impressed he started coming to church. So that was a good thing. Now, Jesus in the memories, we can't change the facts of what actually occurred, but like I said, we can change the feelings. Again, this is experiencing truth, not just making it up. Our submerged memories are very, very alive inside us. They're available to be accessed and able to be healed under guidance. A lot of times, even though we've been able to bury them consciously, they come back in our dreams. The hurts that we've experienced. Professional counselors have learned to access such memories. They typically do not invite the presence of Jesus, but they can get at a lot of the memories anyway, depending only on human power. Human power can help, but it's not likely to bring complete healing. Working in Jesus' power makes healing the usual result. And this is a very important fact, that we have the power of the Holy Spirit enable us to bring healing. Here's Becky's story. She was angry at Jesus for not taking better care of her. But again, we invited Jesus to come, and she was able to see him in the memory. I asked the question, "Would you like to see Jesus in your memory?" And she finally agreed, picturing the truth. The Holy Spirit then enables us to experience the truth when we ask Him. So she went back in the memory and almost immediately saw Jesus standing there, and saw not her adult self interacting with Jesus, but seeing herself at age 12, which is when the abuse happened. And I invited Jesus to give her a hug. That kind of broke through, because she was not only knowing Jesus' love, but she was feeling it. And a lot of this is, a lot of the damage that we're talking about is in the feelings part of us, not in the head part of us. And so we need to deal with feelings. And so she was able to, in that context, she was able to help this 12-year-old inner child part of her to give Jesus the feelings of abuse receive his acceptance in the feeling part of her, not just in the head part of it. One of the things that bothers us, that we really don't understand, is why Jesus let the abuse happen in the first place. And I can't explain that fully, except to say that he honors free will. And when people use their free will for evil purposes, Jesus is there, but he's still honoring their free will, and people get hurt. I've been apprehensive at times when, say, a person is being abused, to invite them to see Jesus there, lest they will get angry at Jesus for not doing very much. But that's only happened a couple of times in hundreds of cases. Almost always, when they experience Jesus in the memory, no matter how painful it is, they're able to release their anger and unforgiveness, and just turn it over to Jesus, and that then brings healing. The few cases that have felt angry about his presence rather than feeling healed, they tend to dissolve in bitterness and just won't let the healing happen, because they're so badly hurt that they don't want to get rid of it, of the hurt. Which brings up another thing, and that is that God's principle in dealing with us is a principle that I call partnership. He works with, I think he's made a rule for himself that he won't work in the human context without a human partner. If this wasn't true, why would he wait 40 years for Moses? Remember that story? It's incredible. He wanted to release the people of Israel, and he wanted Moses to do it. Moses tried and botched it, and then went off and tended sheep for 40 years. And God waited. We would ask, why didn't God just do it by himself? But all the way through the scriptures, you see him partnering with Noah, partnering with Abraham, partnering with each of the heroes of the faith. And in this business of inner healing, he partners with us for our healing. He doesn't just do it by himself. So the principle is, if we are willing to work with him to get healed, he's willing to heal us. If we just want to sit back and say, okay, God, you're all-powerful, so you heal me, I'm not going to do anything except just sit here, that kind of person doesn't get healed. Are you following me on this? This is a very, very important principle. In a verse that's very often quoted about God's working with us, Romans 8:28, there are at least three translations of that. The worst one is the most common one: "All things work together for good for them who love God." Very poor translation. Another one is, "In everything God works for the good of those who love him." The best translation is, "In everything God works with those who love him for their good." In everything God works with us. And the picture that Jesus draws at one point is a picture of the farmer following his oxen and plowing. Jesus says, "Come to me, all of you who are tired from carrying heavy loads, and I'll give you rest." And he says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn of me." Now, a yoke is the farmer's thing. It has two deals like this that go on the necks of the oxen, and you have two oxen pulling the plow, but only one of those oxen is strong. The other one is either an apprentice or an old one who's finished working and his strength is gone. But the job of that second ox is to walk a half a step behind the head ox so that the head ox pulls the whole load. Kind of interesting picture, isn't it? And Jesus presents that as a picture for us. We're in yoke with Jesus, and our job is to be there, but to keep a half a step behind, so that the bulk of the load is pulled by Jesus. So he says, "Take my yoke upon you, and learn of me, or learn from me." Either translation works. then he says, "I'll give you rest." But he's talking about working. How can you rest when you're working? Well, I think what he means is you're working in an attitude of restfulness, an attitude of peacefulness. But he starts it out, he says, "Come to me, all of you who are tired from carrying heavy loads." Tired from carrying heavy loads. And emotional loads are the heaviest loads that we have to carry. But he says, "Come to me, and I'll give you rest." So we invite Jesus to be in, to show us what he was doing in the event. And even though we don't understand what he does and why he does it, he's there. And he's on our side. So in ministry sessions, then Jesus allows us to feel and usually to see his what he's doing, to see his presence there, and we can come to respond to his invitation to come to him. The Holy Spirit guides us as we go from memory to memory. Then I ask the question, what about false memories? A while back there was a big fuss over the fact that some memories seemed to be false, and some psychologists were accused of planting these false memories in people. And I suspect there might be some psychologists who did plant memories, but I think the whole thing was overdone. So the question is, what is our attitude here? Well, my attitude is, I don't care whether the memory is true or false. The issue is not the accuracy of the memory. The issue is healing. And suppose somebody has a false memory of being abused, and we invite that person to forgive the abuser. But the whole thing is not true. I say, so what? Maybe we've wasted a little time getting the person to forgive somebody that wasn't really there or didn't really hurt the person. Or what commonly happens is a memory that of something that actually did happen, the thing that happened gets exaggerated in the person's memory. So what if that happens? And again, I say, I don't care, because the issue is still forgiveness. It's not the accuracy of the memory is not an issue. And if that memory was not true at all, then and we get the person to forgive somebody that that really didn't hurt him or her, maybe we just wasted a little bit of time. Now, a basic principle here is, if there is a memory, not talking about whether it's true or false or little or big or whatever, if there is a memory of something, then probably something did happen. It may not have happened exactly as the person remembers it. It may not be as big a deal as the person remembers. But something did happen, and experiencing Jesus and being able to give him the problem is still the thing that's the proper thing to do. So I don't get fussed up about false memories. In the middle of page 28, there's a bold-faced statement there that I think is important. Knowing the details accurately is seldom necessary for healing. Forgiveness and giving our feelings to Jesus are always necessary. So we don't worry so much about the accuracy there. The next page is talks about repression of memories. We repress memories. Now, where the enemy gets a lot of people here is a lot of people are suffering from what I call fear of the past. I remember one time I said to a lady, I'd like you to, in your memory now, to go back to this event. And she looked at me, and with tears in her eyes, she said, I can't. Said that was just too horrible. And I agreed with her, because this was satanic ritual abuse, and she'd been treated really, really badly. I, I don't want to go into the details, but they were absolutely horrible, almost beyond what you can imagine. And she didn't want to go back there for good reason. Probably if she had gone back, she would be re-traumatized, which is a bad thing to have happen. So I use my favorite prayer. I don't know if you have this one. Mine is, "Help!" Do you have that prayer? Saying, "Okay, Lord, what do I do now?" Kind of thing. And the thing that I'm sure it was the Lord put into my mind, he said, put this event and these, actually there was a series of events, put them as pictures on the wall. And so I said, let's ask Jesus to take these events, these horrible things that happened to you, and instead of making you go through them, let's put them as pictures on the wall. And then I would like you and Jesus to go to those pictures and see what Jesus does. And she did that. We had several pictures on the wall. In another case, not this one, but another case where I advised a person to do it, she saw the whole wall covered with pictures, kind of thing. But in this case, this lady and Jesus went to the wall, and she saw him take his blood and pour that blood over each of the pictures and bring healing. It's one of those fascinating events where you just want to cry or something, because it was just so precious. We were able to avoid re-traumatizing the lady, but we were able to get these things healed, and she was able to forgive some people that absolutely did not deserve to be forgiven, who had done some horrible things to her. So this is another technique that can be used. Now, repression of the memories. These memories are like open wounds. They fester inside of us like physical wounds that have been bandaged but not treated with antiseptic. But repressing memories never gets them healed. And once again, I'll mention this principle. God likes to go straight through things. See, even with these pictures on the wall, we went right straight through the event. We didn't ignore it. We didn't try to repress it. We didn't try to set it aside or whatever. But with Jesus, she went right through those memories and got them healed. And you don't get healed without really facing and going through the problem. Healing can only come by facing the memories with Jesus. Now, this fear of the past is a big thing. Fear to go back to the events that were so hurtful, and it can be painful. But the pain of surgery is different from the pain of whatever the pain of the injury. See, both can be painful, and sometimes I'll say to the person, if you went through surgery, physical surgery, why did you do that, given the fact that you knew going in that it would be painful? Well, they did it because they know on the other side of the pain is healing. And this is the way it is with these emotional wounds. God says, go back to it with Jesus, and we'll get it. It may be painful, but we'll get it healed. This lady that I mentioned that I saw curled up in she saw herself curled up in the corner with her father beating her. That was an awfully painful memory. And she had tears in her eyes going through it. The last thing in the world that she wanted to do was to go back to that memory. But she came out of it healed. And she would gladly do the same again, knowing that on the other side of that pain is the healing. So want to recognize that it may be, the process may be painful, but it is also healing. Now you must have some questions by now. Who's got questions? Yes.
The pictures on the wall, is it a physical wall or a mental wall? When you're helping a client put the pictures on the wall, is it an actual wall that you...
Yeah.
Or is it a mental wall that they're
existing? Okay, so the question is, with putting pictures on the wall, is it an actual wall or is it a mental wall? Well, the whole thing is mental, so it's a... the lady was picturing a wall with the like photographs on it, and it wasn't like an actual physical wall. Yeah.
How far do you push the wall before you realize that it could be over traumatizing?
Okay, there's a good question. How far do we push before we realize that it might be a re-traumatizing thing? That's a judgment call, and in this case, the lady herself said, "I can't go back there." See, I mean, and again, I suspect that if I asked you to imagine the worst thing that could have happened to her, you probably wouldn't have gotten close to the things that actually did happen to her. See, the satanic ritual abusers, they specifically try to do things that people can't imagine, because nobody would believe what a person says if the person is reporting some of that stuff. There probably are times when if you're the counselor, you're feeling that the person might be re-traumatized, and so you step back and do something like the pictures on the wall kind of deal. I've used that technique on several occasions, and at least once it was just to save time. It was not a matter of, I was not afraid that she was going to be re-traumatized, but we were I was trying to hurry because we were running out of time. And she... she saw the pictures, and she saw Jesus take care of them and just blot them out. One person saw Jesus taking the pictures down, putting them in his pocket, and I said, "Boy, he must have a big pocket." He says, "Yeah, he's got a gown on. He keeps putting the pictures in his pocket," and he did indeed have a big. Another person saw the pictures and saw Jesus come with a marking pencil and just scribble all over them. And others have seen him disappear or one person saw him burn up. Jesus took him down and burned each one. That was kind of interesting. It's one of the fun things about this ministry is watching some of the creative things that Jesus does in some of these things. Other questions? Yes.
Willing participant of the healing process. They were too bitter, picturing Jesus there, or too angry. How did you work with that person to resolve that issue?
Yeah, the person that has a hard time letting it go and is angry at Jesus, this is one of the bigger problems. My approach in a deal like that is, first of all, to affirm the person. He or she has a right to be angry at Jesus. But the question then is, what are you willing to do to get healed? And is this coming to Jesus, the one that you feel has let you down? Is that too high a price for you to pay? Or could you do that? And almost without exception, the person says, okay, well, I can try that. It's a risk, and I'm really not feeling good about it. I still feel like Jesus let me down, but I'll try bringing it to him. Think that would work? Because otherwise, it's either take this problem to Jesus, your enemy, you know, the one that you feel is your enemy, or live with it. And, you know, living with it hasn't worked so far, and it probably won't work in the future, and it's certainly not going to help your life at all to be holding this against him. But, you know, Jesus can take a lot of criticism. He can, if you want to, some people are helped by going into a private place and just telling Jesus what they think of him. But he can handle that. The underlying problem is we just don't understand what he's doing and why he's doing it that way. And see, part of our culture, part of our life is trying to control things by understanding them. See, that's a control mechanism. We think if we can just understand this, then we've got control of it. And we really don't feel good about having things that we can't control. We call this a tolerance for ambiguity. If you want a technical name for it, tolerating questions that we don't have answers for. That's a very painful thing. How many of you have questions that you don't have answers for? See, that affects all of us. And when it comes to personal hurt, it's particularly difficult. We would like to be able to say Jesus did this for this reason. And there are theological positions that try to understand. So they, quite often they'll say, well, Jesus wanted to teach me patience, and so he took me through this. I have a theological word for that. Baloney. He doesn't take us places for the purpose of testing us. In fact, it says in the Lord's Prayer, don't take us to strong testing, kind of thing. Jesus prayed against that that concept specifically. A lot of the things that happen in our lives are not meant to help us. They're the result of attacks of an enemy that is trying to destroy us. And our ultimate refuge is Jesus. We have no better refuge than that. And even if we don't understand him, even if we are holding some things against him, my basic thing is, well, let's experiment. Let's try giving it to Jesus and see if this works. It's worked for person after person after person that I've worked with, and it just might work for you too. And so, you come to Jesus with tears in your eyes and you say, Jesus, I really don't feel like doing this. I don't trust you. It feels like you're trying to hurt me, but I'm going to take a chance. I'm going to bring this to you, and I'm going to try and take my hands off it. And that usually works. Really good question, huh? Thank you. What's the youngest age that I worked with? I don't work really well with young children, because it takes a long time. You got to establish rapport. You got to get their confidence and so on. So what I usually do with children is try to train their mother. And I had a delightful story of a couple that had a young lady, a 7-year-old girl, that they had adopted from Ethiopia. from an Ethiopian non-Christian background. I assumed that the child had been dedicated to spirits. They usually are. And so I counseled the mother on that issue and a few other things. We spent a couple hours actually trying to help her to understand what was going on. About a week after this time that we were together, the mother and this little girl were in a store, some kind of a shop or other, and the little girl looked up at his mother and says, "Mother," he says, this spirit is really bothering me." And so the mother came at the spirit and said, "Listen here, this girl does not belong to you, it belongs to me. I am her mother. I have authority over her," and talking like that. And the little girl says, "Boy, you're really getting him mad. He's really angry at you now." And so the mother came back and said, "Listen, I told you, she is mine, she is not yours, I'm taking her away from you," and so on. And then the little girl says, "He's gone. He's gone, he's completely gone." See, she knew the spirit was there, and she knew when the spirit was gone. I saw my job as trying to teach the mother how to conduct spiritual warfare over her child. And I've had a few other experiences. One little guy, he's about 4 or 5 years old, I guess. He calls me Dr. Grandpa. He says, "Dr. Grandpa." I worked with a 12-year-old who was actually the demons would come on him, and he'd get angry, and he would actually physically fight his mother. He would pound on her, kind of thing. And it took a couple of sessions, but we got him free. And one of the things that that went on in that is I think the Lord has told me to work with the mother too, because a lot of his problems, the things that gave the demons a right to him, had come by inheritance through his mother, and so we ministered to her as well. So another story: a lady that had been sitting in one of my seminars, she went home afterwards, and she said to her 4-year-old daughter, she said, "You know, Mommy didn't want you." And the little girl said, "I know it." But from that basis of bringing into the open her attitude towards the little girl, they got healed. The little girl got healed, and she was able to say to her, "But I've changed my mind. I do want you," kind of thing. That was really, really special. So those are some of my stories on working with children. Other questions?
If you have someone that has many memories over many years, different people, how do you try and lead that? Do you want to risk giving them a thing, or do you just let them lead themselves on the memories that are significant to them?
Now, you're suggesting that this person had a number of different abusers? Is that what you're talking about? Well, you just, you start going through them one by one, and usually then the Holy Spirit will heal a whole bunch of them all at once. One of the things that helps is picturing something. I often say, let's picture Jesus with a great big basket next to him, or or a trash can or something, and we're going to throw your problems into that basket, including the people who have abused you. So you end up with a lot of people in the basket, as well as the problems, and that's often a very helpful way of picturing, taking this and giving it to Jesus. See, this approach to healing is an active approach. We don't just sit there and let him heal. We we do something. We give give Jesus the things that that hurt. Does this address your question, or did I miss it? Okay. Other questions? Yes.
My pastor before in New York, he's very into healing as well, and he has two little girls. And one time he said sometimes he wondered what he was doing with his little girls would somehow, because I guess my question is sometimes we try to be as careful with people as possible, not to hurt them, not to give them bad memories or even as parents, right? But then I think it's very hard to be careful to such a degree. For example, it's not easy, it's not possible to not even step on one ant as we walk through our daily life. So when we deal with people or little children, or how can we be so, how much do we have to do in order to not to know that we, to not hurt people accidentally.
I guess we just have to do our best kind of thing, because kids don't come with direction books, do they? If they did, we probably wouldn't read the book anyway. But and we don't have any really good teaching and experience to help us, so we do the best we can. And spend a lot of time praying. One of the things that is effective for a lot of people is to pray over their little children while they're asleep. And sometimes, if the child has picked up demons, they get to while the child is asleep, the demon will often talk to them, kind of deal. So that's helpful, but learning as much as we can about how Satan works and what to do about it is really, really important in bringing up our children. Yes. Yeah, your basic question is what? I missed it.
How does Satan use spirits and demons?
Oh yeah, we've got a whole chapter on demons, so we'll get to that. Be patient. Yeah, probably next session we'll get to it. There's a hand back there. Wait for this. I can't hear you at all. Sorry.
My question is, can we practice this on believers and non-believers, both, or only Christians?
Yeah, that's a good question. Basically, this is for Christians. But I can... I can picture a situation where a non-Christian comes and we could say to him, okay, I work in the power of Jesus. If you're willing for me to do that, then okay, let's try it. There are some risks involved, though, because if we deal with demons and you don't, you know, if you're not close to Jesus, you could really get clobbered because you have no real protection against them. And so I would go at that very carefully. On a couple of occasions, well, one was a lady, a counselor brought this lady to me, and I had heard some very favorable stories about the counselor and what she had done to help this lady. The counselor's name was Joy. And so I started working with this with her client, and one of the first things I said was, what's your relationship with Jesus? And she said, I don't think I have any. She said, I've tried this church, and I've tried that church, and I've tried other things, but she had, you know, very poor experience with several churches. And again, I used my favorite prayer. Help! And then I said, would you accept Joy's Jesus? Joy being the counselor. And this lady looked at me with the sweetest smile on her face and said, I'll accept that Jesus. See, the fact that that counselor had gone way out of her way, and I heard stories of how she had helped this lady and so on, that spoke to her. And so right there she accepted the Lord. Later on, when I was dealing with the demons, I said to, I think it was the spirit of death, I said, did something change in your relationship with this lady just now? And he said, oh yes. He said, when she came to Christ, I knew it was all over for me. That's the demon speaking. The demon knew that he was finished. And so we were able to get rid of the demons and a whole bunch of other stuff and get her free. So that's just, yeah. I worked with another a fellow who claimed to be a Christian, but I think he was just claiming that, and what we did didn't seem to help him very much. So this is basically for Christians, and if you notice in the New Testament, Jesus said he came to set captives free. He wasn't saying that to non-Christians. He was saying that to Christians. See, and like I said last night, Christianity is at least a two-step process. There's the salvation step, and then there's the freedom step. And we've got a lot of Christians are wonderfully saved, but not free. And so this is, I think this is what Jesus was talking about when he talked about freedom. He didn't say much at all about salvation, but he said a lot about freedom. There's a lot in the New Testament about getting free. So my feeling is that all churches should incorporate inner healing. In fact, I've worked with a couple of churches now that have made inner healing a prerequisite to membership. The early church, back in the first century, they believed that everybody converted out of the world was carrying demons. I think that's still true, but we don't do anything about it. So we've invited into our churches a lot of people that are under demonic oppression. So, but we'll talk about demons a little bit later. One thing you learn once you start talking about demons, you don't get on any other subject. But there's plenty about it. This book has got one chapter. I've also written a book, Defeating Dark Angels. The whole book is about dealing with demons. And I've had a lot of experience hopefully can help you. Now, one of my desires is that many of you will get busy in this kind of ministry. See, we all have the power of the Holy Spirit. We all can do this ministry. We all have the same, we start out with the same amount of power. The difference is experience. And one of the things, a lot of people sort of sit there and say, well, Dr. Kraft can do this, he's gifted or whatever. And, I have this theological word again, baloney. I don't have spectacular gifting. I just have given what I've got to Jesus, and he does wonderful things. He could do the same thing with you. In your families, in your associations, whatever. And so take that. Will you be good at it when you first start? No. Will you make mistakes? Yep. That's the only way you learn. But I covet for each of you. It's a thrilling thing to see people get free. And you can learn a lot of stuff here that can help you to get free. You can use that in ministry to yourself, but you can also do ministry with other people. And this book is called 2 Hours to Freedom. It usually takes about 2 hours for me. It may take 3 hours for you, but it's still a fairly short time. The next chapter, I don't think you have the notes on it, but I've got another 5 minutes here. The next one is talking about what I call our inner selves. Do you talk to yourself? My mother used to say, I talk to myself because that's the only way I can get intelligent conversation. My father questioned whether it was intelligent or not. Oh, good, thank you. But one way or another, we find out that there are many parts to us, whether we're talking about different roles or not. I talk and interact with my grandchildren quite a lot differently than I do in teaching a graduate level courses at Fuller Seminary. There's a sense, I mean, sometimes people that have been in my classes get to visit in our home and they see a whole different person. And we all do that. Many of us, we have the role of son or daughter. We have a different role in our business activities, in our church activities, and so on. Now, there's this concept that we call inner child. How many of you have found inner children inside you? Anybody? Few? If you want to find an inner child, go back to a time when you were being abused. This abuse might have been physical or sexual or emotional, or feeling unwanted or rejected or something like that. But see if you can identify an age at which you experience something like what I'm calling abuse. Now, how many of you have, when you find that that person that you were at age 8 or age 10 or 12 or 15 or whatever, when you can identify that person, you've found an inner child. It's a pretty well established approach in secular psychology, and it's very, very useful for us. You have inner children, you have inner adults. By the time we get through a ministry session, we've usually found maybe 30 or 40 different inner people inside us. Now, this is a way of dealing with memories, because these inner people are holding on to the memories of what happened during the time when they were out. Those of you that were here 2 years ago, I think I showed a DVD at that time of a young lady, and one of her inner children was a 15-year-old. who had been raped. A very painful experience. But we could talk to the 15-year-old. We could interact with that part of her. And in fact, the adult, her name was Julie, she was about 26 years old, and the 15-year-old would do things together in this ministry session kind of thing. And we were able to get that 15-year-old healed so that that she forgave the man who had taken advantage of her. And she gave up her anger towards Jesus. And that 15-year-old part got healed, which meant that the 26-year-old person was getting healed. It's a wonderful story. Now I start out here in lesson 4 with a story of someone that I call Amelia. She found that she was over-disciplining her children. She loved them, but she would frequently lose her temper when she was disciplining them, and then she would over-discipline them, and then she would feel very guilty and very bad about the fact that she had lost control. Now, what we did was we went back to the time before her birth and found out that her mother didn't want her. In fact, as she had her eyes closed and she was picturing herself in her mother's womb, all of a sudden she starts saying, poking, poking, poking. She was experiencing her mother trying to abort her. And this was indelibly a part of her memories, her mind. She was constantly affected by this memory. She had deep-seated anger towards her parents, and she didn't really know where that came from. But we discovered the roots of her anger in her mother's attempt to abort her. She was ashamed over not being wanted. She believed lies about herself. She was dedicated by her family to Chinese gods, and this was a factor in the whole thing too. And then there was a series of unpleasant experiences throughout her life. This concept of unwantedness, she was not wanted, and the way this was coming out again was by over-disciplining her children. We were able to deal with that. She was able to forgive herself. She was able to accept what Jesus had done. Jesus had kept her mother from aborting her, kept her from killing her. She left very free, and that's a story of these experiences that we've had. Now I think we need to take a break for lunch, do we? And we'll leave it at that.
Let's thank Dr. Kraft for this afternoon. Mm-hmm.